consume a lot of media. By that I mean they watch a lot of movies, and they don't always watch them on TV. Sometimes they'll see them on an iPad or they'll see them on their computer. But if you watch too much media and forget that it's all make-believe, your reality becomes distorted. For instance, if you just watch the movies and didn't know anything else about life, you might think that reality was like this. In the movies, all grocery shopping bags contain at least one French bread baguette. You would think, too, that the ventilation system of any building is the perfect hiding place. You would think that the Eiffel Tower in Paris can be seen from any window in Paris. You would notice that a man will show no pain while taking the most ferocious beating from other men, but will wince when a pretty woman tries to clean his wounds. You will notice that every car that crashes will burst into flames. You'll notice that people knocked unconscious will never suffer a concussion or brain damage. That one really gets to me. When I was a six-year-old, I slipped on the ice and hit my head, and I was unconscious. And I mean to tell you, I had a concussion for a couple of days. That was so painful and nauseous and miserable. And then you see these guys, and they get smacked with a baseball bat. They fall down, they get back up. Well, let's go after the bad guys. You'll find in movies that any lock can be picked by a credit card or a paperclip in seconds, unless it's the door to a burning building with a child trapped inside. Then the door has to be kicked in. All bombs are fitted with electronic timing devices with large red readouts, so you know exactly how much time you have to disarm them. In the movies, even medieval peasants had perfect teeth. In the movies, it's unnecessary to say hello or goodbye when beginning or ending a phone conversation. In the movies, any person waking from a nightmare will sit bolt upright and begin panting. And last of all, it doesn't matter if you're heavily outnumbered. If you're in a martial arts fight, your enemies will wait to attack you one by one while dancing around menacingly until you have knocked out the predecessor. That's how it is in the movies. Well, we're talking about reality, and we're talking about a reality that's rooted in the past but involves the future. If you're aware of some of the prophecy things that are in Scripture, and if you're at all aware of what some of the prophecy folks on TV have to say, you realize that there's a strong case for us living in the end times. And there's occasionally some terminology that may be unfamiliar to you. And so I thought we would spend today just explaining one term that you're starting to hear from time to time. It's called the abomination of desolation. Have you heard that? The abomination of desolation. Well, Pastor Dale is going to help me here. We're going to make a timeline up here. That 2015 goes over there on that rail. We're going to make a timeline. Right over here is going to be today. Yep, put it up right there. This is going to be today, 2015. And then find the one that that says Jesus on it. And then you can go to Abraham. I'll put that one up. Good. This will be excellent. It's not TV and it's not a movie, but it's next door to it. All right. So here is B.C. and A.D. And notice that Jesus, there we go, Jesus is just on the other side of A.D. He was probably born about 4 B.C. or 6 B.C. They made a little problem, a mistake in the calculation on the calendar. Everything that happened to Jesus is A.D. And then Abraham is going to be way over there on that music stand. Abraham was about 2,100 B.C. He was about the same distance from Jesus that we are today. Isn't that amazing? It's incredible to think about that. Abraham was that far away. There you go. Now, the book of Daniel would happen right about here, or maybe over there a little bit. The book of Daniel is right in here. So what we're going to talk about is this term, abomination of desolation, and it shows up in Matthew 24. Jesus is at the end of his earthly ministry, and it says, now as Jesus was going out of the temple courts and walking away, his disciples came to show him the temple buildings. Why would they be doing that? Because they continued to work on that temple for over 30 years. It was a constant construction project, and something had been going on, and they wanted to show it to Jesus. They were just amazed. And he said to them, do you see all these things? I'm telling you the truth. Not one stone will be left on another. All will be torn down. And it was going to be torn down about the year 70, which would be right here. So Jesus is going to die. He's going to die right here around 33, 34 AD. And then within just less than 50 years, that thing is going to be torn down. As he was sitting on the Mount of Olives and his disciples came to him privately away from the crowd, they said, tell us, when will these things happen and what will be the sign of your coming at the end of the age? He says, watch out that no one misleads you. That's a key right there. He said, just before I return again, there's going to be a lot of false information out there, and it will be easy to be confused. It'll be easy to be seduced off of the right path. Verse 7, for nation will rise up in arms against nation and kingdom against kingdom. There will be famines, earthquakes in various places. All these things are the beginning of birth pains. So they call them the birth pangs of the kingdom or the Messiah. And because lawlessness will increase so much, verse 12, the love of many will grow cold. But the person who endures to the end will be saved, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached throughout the whole inhabited earth as a testimony to all nations. Then the end will come. And here's our key phrase, verse 15. So when you see the abomination of desolation, and he qualifies it by explaining what he means, spoken about by Daniel the prophet. When you see this abomination of desolation standing in the holy place, let the reader understand, then those in Judea must flee to the mountain. So this is the key verse. When you see the abomination of desolation spoken about by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then you need to take action. What is this abomination of desolation? Well, when Jesus makes reference to it, he's actually talking about something from the book of Daniel. Daniel lived several hundred years before Jesus. He had these visions. Now, ironically enough, he refers back to a temple that existed when he was a child, or maybe just before he was born, and then it was destroyed by these invaders. And so during the life of Daniel, there's really not a temple to refer to. There's a bunch of rocks and things like that, but he's actually in captivity in a totally different land. Most of his life takes place in a totally different land. The passage followed a vision that the prophet Daniel had in the year 536 BC. It was a terrible vision, and so he wanted to understand its meaning. So he read and he prayed. Daniel's in his 80s right now. Now, all throughout his life, he's had visions and he's had messengers, angels who will come. It's an incredible story in the book of Daniel. But At the end of this thing, he's about 83 years old. God sends an angel to communicate with him. What the angel said is recorded in Daniel chapter 11. And this is what we think Jesus was referring to. It says, his forces will rise up and profane the fortified sanctuary, stopping the daily sacrifice. In its place, they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. That's from Daniel 11:31. His forces will rise up, profane the fortified sanctuary, stopping the daily sacrifice. In its place, they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. Let's include a little bit more. Let me give you the story of what Daniel is talking about. In Daniel chapter 11, verse 21, he says, there will arise in his place a despicable person to whom the royal honor has not been rightfully conferred. He will come on the scene in a time of prosperity and will seize the kingdom through deceit. Now, he's prophesying in 536, but the events that he is talking about first occur right over here in about 175 to 164 in this area. And what happens is he's talking about a guy named Antiochus Epiphanes. He was a descendant of Alexander the Great's generals, and he lived in Syria. Go ahead and give me that map, if you would. You see, Damascus is right up there by Lebanon. And so Antiochus had his whole zone right up there in the north. Now, his name, Epiphanes, means bright, brilliant light. Antiochus, the bright one. But the Israelites behind his back didn't call him Epiphanes, they called him Epimenes. That means dim light or dimwit. Now, we don't know all the details on how he came to power, but it's true that his brother was in power first, and then all of a sudden his brother dies, and here comes Antiochus in control. Now, he comes in at a time when there's a lot of prosperity, but he is greedy and he wants more. And so what does he do? He decides he's going to go down to Egypt, down on that other yellow end, and there he is going to attack the Ptolemies, the Egyptians. And this, in fact, he does. Now, when most people raised armies, they would have a certain number of their military that were professional, and that's what they did for their living. But a lot of the armies back then were actually raised within the society. There were people who didn't have work. They were men who were ruthless, and they had ideas about becoming rich, because that was the deal. The understanding was that when you went into battle, if you were victorious, you would be able to keep the spoil. You'd be able to keep whatever you conquered. And so they would go down there with these guys. They sacked and they pillaged. They did all kinds of things down in Egypt. They came back and they were rich. He will come on the scene in time of prosperity, will seize the kingdom by deceit. This wicked king is able to conquer everyone he fights at first. And so he picks a fight with the Egyptians and he beats them. Daniel continues in his prophecy that he sees. These two kings, their mind filled with evil intentions, talking about Antiochus and then the king of the Egyptians, will trade lies with one another at the same table, but it will not succeed, for there is still an end at the appointed time. Now, Antiochus goes back home rich with spoil, but in his self-congratulation, he decides that he needs to go down there again. He starts thinking of Egypt as his ATM. You know, if they had ATMs, give me that next one. See, there it is, the ATM. He's thinking, it was so easy to get money, I am going to go back to the ATM. He's only home like a year, and then he decides he needs more. And so he heads back down there. Now, there's a problem with this business of going back and forth all the time. And that's that the Egyptians were great at producing grain. And so much of what they produce was traded with Rome. And Rome was a power in the ascendancy at that time. And so on the second time down, he heads down. Then the king of the north will return to his own land, much property. His mind will be set against the Holy Covenant. He goes down there, but apparently this time, a Roman general named Gaius Popilius Laenus confronts Antiochus on the beach just when he's getting ready to take money out of that ATM a second time. Now, he doesn't have nearly the number of soldiers that Antiochus does, but he represents the greatest superpower on earth. And he says, I have come with a message from the Roman Senate. And Antiochus the dimwitted says, what? He says, you are not to be messing with Egypt. It is causing our grain prices to skyrocket. And if you go down there and take money out of that ATM and steal money again, you're going to suffer for it. So don't do it. You got to turn around and go back. And Antiochus is indignant. He says, well, I'll just have to think about it. And that general Linnaeus took a stick and he drew a circle around Antiochus. And he says, you will not leave that circle until you decide and tell me your decision. And Antiochus was absolutely humiliated. He had to say, okay, and turn around. The problem is, though, that no ruler in his right mind is going to take an army that was set on getting rich, and they have weapons and they're ready to kill. You don't take them back home hungry and empty-handed. You simply cannot do that. And so the first thing he started to do was to look around for another ATM that he could rob. And he thought, wait a minute, there in Jerusalem, I pass it all the time on my way to Egypt. He says, there's a temple there. It's filled with gold. And this little kingdom that I pass through all the time that has never done me any harm, I don't think they have much of an army at all. Let's swing by Jerusalem and see if we can rob that ATM. And it says he will turn back and direct his indignation against the Holy Covenant. All of this told to him by an angel hundreds of years before it came to pass. Isn't that amazing? Every detail. He will return and honor those who forsake the Holy Covenant. His forces will rise up and profane the fortified sanctuary. He's talking about the Temple Mount, stopping the daily sacrifice. When the temple was working, there was always something called the Tamid. They would sacrifice a lamb in the morning, and they would sacrifice another lamb in the afternoon. And it was called the Tamid. The smoke of the fire of those burnt offerings would go up twice a day. And when he stopped the Tamid, he was messing with Almighty God. He says, not only will he stop the daily sacrifice, but in its place, they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. And this is what he did in December of 167 BC. Then with smooth words, he will defile those who have rejected the covenant, but the people who are loyal to their God will act valiantly. Here's what the abomination of desolation refers to. Antiochus ended the daily sacrifice to God, but not only did he defile the temple by going up into the holy places to do this, but he also renamed the temple, not to God Yahweh, but now it was to the Olympian god Zeus. And then on the burnt altar outside of the holy place of the Holy of Holies, he sacrificed a pig. He sacrificed a pig. Now, bacon was not on the agenda or not on the menu of any Jew in Israel. In fact, it's still hard to find in Israel today, although if you hang with me, I can usually find it. But it really was not anywhere to be found because it was considered a dirty animal. He sacrificed a pig on the altar of God in the holy place, so says Josephus. He sent his army throughout the land to cause all the holy people to quit sacrificing to God and to only sacrifice to himself as a god and to the other gods. Also, the holy people were forbidden to circumcise their sons. And he was so mean about this that he hung the mothers of boys who had had the sign of the covenant in their flesh. He hung them. He's going throughout the land. He doesn't just do it there, but he goes in every major city. He sends his soldiers out, and he forces them to sacrifice and eat a piece of pig flesh. This is called the abomination of desolation. It is when the ruler, the unjust ruler, forces the people of God to defile themselves with worship of another god or some type of idolatry. Do you see what I'm talking about? That's what he refers to as the abomination of desolation. So when you see the abomination of desolation spoken about by Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand that those in Judea must flee to the mountains. Now, there are some people that are waiting for the temple to be rebuilt. There's a whole group of people. There are American financial wizards with a lot of money that actually have been sending money to Israel. And there's an institute over there where they study all of the utensils used in the temple. They actually have made a completely gold candelabra, a menorah. They actually have shovels, and they have all the bowls and things that are supposed to be made just a certain way, ready for the temple. They're just waiting to rebuild the temple. Some Christians say, well, we don't need to worry because there is no temple. The Temple Mount now has on it the Al-Aqsa Mosque and a beautiful dome building called the Dome of the Rock, but they're both Muslim structures. And so some people are saying, well, we don't need to worry because the abomination of desolation can't happen unless the temple has been rebuilt. The interesting thing is, though, Daniel talks about this thing when there is no temple. Jesus talks about it when there is a temple, but it's just before it's destroyed. There was almost another activity that happened right here when Caligula set up his own image, and he had it brought down. He was going to have it set up in the temple, but it never happened. My question then is, do you need a real temple, and do you need to have a real altar to be desolate? When the place that was holy during the time of Abraham, it was holy during the time of Moses, holy during the time of Jesus, this Temple Mount now has on it a place where you can call out to Allah, another god. Now, we can't answer these questions. You just can't answer them. Some will say, no, you got to wait for a literal temple. Others say, no, you know what? The space itself is already defiled. But the thing that sticks in my brain is when Daniel saw things like this that were hard for him to understand, his normal practice was to pray and fast and fast and pray. And he was hundreds of years before even the Messiah, and almost 2,000 years before our time. Friends, I don't think God is looking around at all these prophecy teachers and saying, Tina, I got to remember to make sure to do that before I come. I don't think that he is worried about their prophecy schedules. I'll tell you one thing, though. When God moves, he seems to do it in ways that we never could have predicted. And yet they're always consistent with his holy plan. They're always consistent with his personality. That's why I'm not sitting here counting this week and counting that week. I'm not counting weeks. That's why I'm not listening to this guy and then listening to this guy and listen to this guy. I'll listen to them, but you know what? We should always be ready. We ourselves should always be ready for the Lord to come back at any time. And if we're smart like Daniel, we need to be in prayer and fasting. I'm calling us to a time of prayer. I'm going to start prayer meetings on Sunday nights. And I encourage you to come. And I encourage you to think about fasting. Now, you can fast a lot of different things. You can fast food. Not fast food. You can fast food. You could fast food. You could say, I'm only going to eat the good stuff. I'm not going to eat the other stuff. Except for Chick-fil-A, that's really good. I think they put crack in their sandwiches. They are so addicting. You could fast food. You could fast food. You could fast TV. You could fast movies. You could fast music. You talk to the Lord and let him show you what to fast. But set aside something for a certain amount of time and say, I will not enjoy this. And instead, I will commit myself to pray. He may give us insights like he did Daniel. But at the very least, he will make sure that you are ready for whatever is to come. We are not supposed to live in a state of fear. We, of all people, are to live with the assurance of knowing that our God has everything under control. I know that there are people out there looking for a red heifer. That's another term. And I hope they find one. I know that there are people looking for this thing and looking for that. I also know that there's a county clerk in jail down in Kentucky. She's a Christian. And she's in jail because she decided that she was not going to be part of this anti-Christian movement. And she decided to break the law and do civil disobedience. And she is in jail. I've been praying for her. I hope you will too. You know, it comes down to the point where you've got to draw the line with your conscience. And if there's no difference between me and the pagan next door, then I've got to ask myself, am I really a Christian? Am I really a Christian? Where is your line? Where is your line? It's through prayer that we begin to understand what God requires. And it's through fasting that we are emboldened and empowered and strengthened so that we can meet his concerns and the things that he sends our way. I think perhaps we need to do just what Daniel did when he was troubled by his visions, enter into a time of prayer and fasting. I'd like to invite the musicians to come. We're begin to worship and call out on his name. Let's all stand. You know, it's high time, I think, that we begin to focus on the Lord. If you look at the news, it's too frightening. If you've lived a long time and you understand how it used to be, it could be very frightening. But I got to tell you something. The people of the Lord know the Lord. And when you know the Lord, you know that you don't have to be afraid. He is able. He is competent. He has a great plan. He may tell us or he may not. But you know what? I'm ready. You should be ready too.